may have to raise to you an interesting difficulty, what the Rambam writes. To solve it, you'll have to go back and think again about the way free will works. In the beginning of the 10th chapter, Ramali says, a person should not say, behold, I'm doing this mitzvah of the Torah and occupying myself with its wisdom in order to receive the blessings that are written in it, or to merit life in the world to come. A person should not say that he's doing the mitzvahs or occupying himself with the wisdom of the Torah either for the blessings that are written in it, which apply in this world, or for meriting the world to come. And he goes on, shouldn't say, I will separate myself from the transgressions that the Torah prohibited in order that I should save myself from the curses written in the Torah, or that I shouldn't be cut off from the world to come, like in the world to come. It's not appropriate to serve God in this manner. For the one who serves God in this manner is serving God out of fear. And that's not a great position. It's not the position of the prophets, nor the position of the sages. Rather, one should make the effort to be able to serve God out of love. One who served out of love and occupied himself with Torah and mitzvos and walks in the paths of wisdom, not because of anything in the world, not because he fears evil consequences, nor to inherit the good, but he does the emet because it's emet. And in the end, the good will come. That's a great position. Not every sage achieves it. Abraham achieved it. Served God out of love. Moses commands us to work for it. Says Hashem, you should love Hashem your God. Do the mitzvahs out of love. Now let's understand. We're talking about an ideal. A person who serves God in order to get a reward and avoid a punishment is services valid. He has performed the mitzvah, satisfied the mitzvah, and he will be indeed rewarded, and he will be saved from punishment. The consequences will flow. But it's very low level. It's very low quality service. And he can achieve much more if he will serve God without any thought of reward, out of love. Okay, this is a fairly common idea, and people, I think, are familiar with it. Now, the end of the preceding chapter, one paragraph before, the Rambam writes, all Israel, their prophets, and their wise men, desired the Messianic era so that the foreign kingdoms will lose their control and the Jews will be able to spend all their time occupied in Torah, mitzvos, to find relaxation, to delve into wisdom, in order to be able to merit the world to come. All Israel, and he specifies their prophets and their sages, all of them want nis'abu. Taiva is probably the strongest word in Hebrew for desiring something. They all desire the Messianic era, because in the Messianic era, they'll be able to do the things that are necessary to preserve life in the world to come. That sounds like everybody does desire the world to come. Indeed, the previous chapter, in chapter 8, Halacha Zayin, he described King David that way. How much, how greatly David desired life in the world to come. If it were not for the fact that I could hope to see the goodness of Hashem. So the Rambam is this. The Rambam is telling us that everyone does, and I suppose if the prophets and the sages all desire this, everyone should desire. The prophets and the sages, he's not describing them as having one fatal weakness. These, the greatest of all Jews of all time, desired the world to come, then it seems to be appropriate, right, valid, good to desire the world to come. So now, if we are supposed to have this desire to get into the world to come, how then can he tell us that when we perform Torah mitzvot, and we know that the performing Torah mitzvot, we thereby merit life of the world to come, that we shouldn't be doing it for the sake of that desire, which we definitely have. How can you tell me, do A, and the truth is that you have many desires for doing A? Well, I tell you to do A, do it for these desires and not for those. Isn't the engagement of the desire automatic? If I have many desires to do something, I do the thing, then all those desires get fulfilled. Automatic, willy-nilly. So desire seems to be pushing me to do, and there's no question that that's going to be part of my motivation. How can you tell me, desire it, but when you do it, don't do it because you desire it. Or you have three desires for it, but don't do it for number three, only do it for numbers one and two. When the question of shall I do it or not comes up, isn't three going to be there and be active and be part of what pushes me to do it? How can one avoid the fact that three is there and it's active? The person has a job, and he loves the job, and he gets paid, and he wants money for the job. Say, well, but don't take any account of the money. What do we need? I want the money. Also, the job. I have lots of things going on when I do the job. But the money is there. It's part of my personality. And you're telling me I should want the money. Well, if I should want the money, and I'm working, I'm getting the money, how can you tell me that my desire for the money isn't part of my motivation? This bothered me for a long time. Now, I think what we have to do is go back and ask ourselves, what is our picture of how psychology works, how you make decisions, how freedom works, and we'll see that everything depends here on what picture you're operating with. And I'm going to describe three pictures to you. The first two pictures, I don't know how to make this description work. The third picture, it does work. The third picture is quite bubble. I must admit that I had to learn it from a secular philosopher. But when I read it, I said to myself, oh ho, there's the solution to my problem with the Rambam. The secular philosopher never heard of the Rambam. His picture helped me a great deal to understand what's going on here. So let's start. The first picture, which as you see is totally wrong, but it would be a good place to start the description. The first picture is this. I'm a person with various motivations. Hopes, fears, worries, desires, anticipations, inspirations, duties. Needs, goals, all sorts of things going on. Each of these being a motivation, by the way, motive comes from motivation, that's the word motive, and motive means what moves you, makes you move. Each of these things is pushing me. Every time I'm faced with a decision, my motivations come into play. Usually, some motivations push me one way, and some motivations push me the other way. It's a kind of conflict between the various motivations. There are some types of very extreme cases where there isn't a conflict, but in the normal case there is a conflict. All different kinds of conflicts. For example, I desire A and B. I can't have both. Just desire. I have to make a choice. Which one shall I get? Or I desire A and I'm afraid of A. So my desire pushes me to take it, and my fear pushes me to avoid it. Or I desire A, but I know that A is wrong. So my desire for A pushes me to take it, and my knowledge that it's wrong pushes me to give it up. There are all these natural motivations. Now, how do we picture a decision being made? I'm in a situation where I can do A or B, and I have certain motivation on the side of A and certain motivation on the side of B. Is it just a tug of war? Is it just a tug of war? These are pulling me this way, and those are pulling me that way. And wherever the strongest pull is, that's the way in which I will go, because I'm pulled in that direction. Is that the picture of how the decision is made? Well, if that's the picture of how the decision is made, then what I just quoted to you from the Rambam is absolutely impossible. Because the desire for the world to come is there. It should be there. It's right for it to be there. So it's automatically there. And when I do an action that will in fact earn me the world to come, that desire is there pushing me. How can you tell me that I shouldn't do it for that reason, that I shouldn't be part of my motivation? It's automatically part of my motivation. If that's your picture. Of course, if that's your picture, also there's no free will. Right? It's just the push-pull of the motivations that you have. There's no room for free will in that picture at all. This really is a picture of an animal. Animals, too, can desire something and be afraid of it. And you find animals in confusion sometimes because they have contradictory tendencies, contradictory pushes. The medieval philosopher said that you put a donkey exactly in between two bales of hay, they'll starve to death. Because you're being pulled this way, being pulled that way, and you know, if neither is any stronger than the other, they'll never move. They'll stay there and starve to death. So this picture, I mention it explicitly because it's easy to fall into this picture, it's easy to fall into this trap. You always do what you want more. That takes the picture one of mechanics. Each desire comes with a label of strength, and the one that's strongest, or when they combine, the strongest combination wins. That makes you into a squirrel. That leaves no room for free will at all. That means what the Rambam writes here can't be correct, and what the whole idea of free will can't be correct. So that picture has to be rejected. Now a second picture, a picture which I have used on many occasions, because it's important, because I wasn't facing this particular problem. I have my motivations, my desires, my hopes, my fears, my scruples, my values. And they're pushing me in various directions, and they have various strengths. In addition, I have something called free will, which also has a certain strength. Free will is my own decision. It's not pushed or pulled by anything. But it has a certain strength. Now let's imagine that I have A and B open to me, and I desire A with a certain strength, and I desire B with a different strength. If the difference between those two desires is less than the strength of free will, their free will can make the difference. Let's say the desire for A has a value of 70, and the desire for B has a value of 50, and free will has a value of 25. So then, if even if free will decides for B, it can overpower the 70 for A and can enable the person to do it. It'll be a hard decision. They'll have to use almost all of his free will consistently, clearly, focused in a focused manner, but he can do it because free will plus the weaker one outweighs the stronger one. If the desire for A will be 70 and the desire for B will be 20, then free will can't do it. Hasn't got enough power to make the difference. A is what's going to happen willy-nilly. And indeed, we recognize that free will doesn't always have the power to overcome the difference in forces. Indeed, if you take the most extreme example, let's say all your desires on one side, you have none on the other side. So then everyone says, under those conditions, you would have no free will. As an example of that, if that sounds too extreme, an example I saw on a philosophy paper many years ago, you're standing next to a pool, and right at your feet, an 18-month-old baby falls into the pool. Unless you take him out, he's going to drown. Now, all you have to do is lean over and grab his shirt and pull him out. Let's see, said the author of this paper. What in your motivation is in favor of pulling him out? I'm not talking about imaginary monsters now. I'm talking about you, normal human being. What are your motivations in favor of taking him out? Well, they said, you have a human life, and the parents will love you forever, and people will respect you, and you feel that you did something significant and important, and so forth and so on. And what, said the author, in your motivation is against pulling the child out? If you are a normal human being, nothing. I mean, nothing. There's nothing that would say, yeah, but if I don't pull it out, I'll get X. What are you going to get? You won't even save a cleaning bill on your pants, you know. You'll pick them up and you'll put them on the grass and you won't even get wet. Under those conditions, said the author of this paper, you're not exercising free will. Free will requires conflict. There has to be some measure of conflict. Now, we agree to that. That's why we're created with a soul and a body, so that there will be conflict. And under the conditions of conflict, we can exercise free will. So the second picture, and as I said, this picture that I've used quite often, the second picture is this. I have all these motivations, and they each have their own strengths. Free will also has some strength. And you could add free will to the weaker side and make it stronger when the difference is less than the power of free will. And that's how you can make free decisions. It doesn't always happen. But when the difference between them is within the range of the power of free will, then free will can make a difference. Right? Now, according to that picture, we understand that free will is a real agency and that it is active, effective, at least in some cases, to make free decisions. What about the Rambam's description here? Can I explain what the Rambam says here on the basis of that picture? The Rambam says here, you should desire the world to come, but you shouldn't serve God because of that desire. That desire shouldn't be part of your motivation. On this picture, I don't think you can make that work. Because on this picture, the best you can do is add your free will to your desires to change the outcome. But the desires are all there, and the desires are all active. They're all functioning. Indeed, in this case, what he's telling you to do is this. Do the mitzvah for which you have two reasons, two desires, but don't do it for one. So I'm acting in favor of the desire, but the desire shouldn't be active. The desire shouldn't contribute. In my picture, you can't make that work. The picture that I just gave you isn't going to make that work. Because in my picture, the free will is just an added power. It's just an added agency. But can't subtract. That's why I was facing this problem for many years. I think at one point I cooked up an explanation where someone doesn't really need it. It was desperate because I was desperate. Then, 2 years ago, I read a book by John Searle, a contemporary philosopher. And he made a very remarkable statement. He had the picture of decision within which the Rambam's comment will work, and he stresses this very point. He says, when you make a decision, part of the decision is which of your motivations will be the reason for the decision. part of the decision is which of your motivations will be the reason for the decision. Your decision can be made for the sake of certain motivations and not others. And the others are just neutralized. They sort of put them in neutral. The gears aren't engaged and they don't drive the car. Here's this example. I went to college with a guy, he says, and he was one of my, it's just an example. Right? So I'm the guy about whom the example is told. I went to college with this fellow Joe, and we were great drinking companions. Joe's also very smart, and nice person, good person. Joe was into politics, and he developed certain political positions, with which I agree. And he's now running for president. And I'm considering who to vote for. And I say, you know, I really would like to see Joe become president. For two reasons. Number one, he has good policies. Good person. I trust him. And number two, we were drinking buddies. And I like it when my drinking buddies are successful. In fact, I really try to help my drinking buddies. You know, whenever one of them gets in trouble, gives me a call, I do whatever I can to help them. So, you know, there are two reasons that I would like to see Joe become president. Two desires I have for him to become president. But I realize that the second reason, the reason that I like to see my drinking buddies be successful, is not a reason to vote for the president of the United States. That's not how you vote for something as important as that. So he said, I'm going to vote for him. But I'm only voting for him because of his policies. I'm not taking our drinking past into account. I'm not taking it into account. Even though, if he wins, that would be part of my pleasure. It would be part of my pleasure, part of my happiness that he wins, that a drinking buddy did well. Because I want my drinking buddies to do well. But I'm not taking it into account. I'm not using it. That's not part of why I'm doing it. My goal of doing it, my reason for doing it, is only because he has better policies. Now let's think. Is that really possible? Could a person do that? Let me offer you a case where it would make a difference. And then we'll start and discuss it. What difference would it make whether he does this or he doesn't do this? And I'll offer you the case, and I'll say something to make sure that it isn't misunderstood, and then we'll stop and discuss. Let's imagine there are two candidates for this election, Joe and somebody else. Now, when this guy thinks about Joe and his opponent, about their policies, their positions, their economics, their politics, he says, Joe has the better positions. So I'm going to vote for him. And I'm not taking into account my desire for drinking buddies to succeed. How would that show? Well, imagine that on reconsidering, the guy says, oh, I didn't realize that Joe took this position and that position. Not as good as I thought. In fact, I think now that Joe had slightly worse positions than his opponent. Slightly worse. Just a little worse. A tiny bit worse. The difference is so small that in terms of desire and in terms of pleasure, the desire that drinking buddies should succeed clearly is greater than the difference in their political power. So that if the desire for the drinking buddy to succeed is working, then under these conditions, it ought to make the difference and you ought to vote for Joe anyway. But according to this picture that Searle suggested, he can discount it. He can simply discount it so it has no weight. This is not the first picture of a kind of mechanical summing up of pleasures or desires. If it were, he'd have to vote for Joe, even when his policies are worse, because his policies are only a little worse, and he has the desire for the drinking buddy to succeed, and together that's the strongest desire, so he has to vote that way. according to my picture, the intermediary picture, he may be able to vote for the other guy, but, or he may be able to vote for Joe, either way, but the desire for the drinking buddy to succeed is playing a role. It's just that it can be overcome by his free will. According to Searle's picture, he simply discounted. He says, yeah, it's true. Joe's apologies are a little worse. On the other hand, I do want drinking buddies to succeed. But I'm going to vote for the other guy anyway. Because my desire that drinking buddies should succeed isn't appropriate to make the difference. That's not the kind of desire that should make the difference in a case of who should be president of the United States. So what Searle is saying is that in a decision, you don't just decide what to do, but you also decide for what reason you're acting. And it's possible to decide to do the same action for two different reasons. And to decide, I'm doing it, and I'm doing it for this reason, and not for that reason. That's part of the decision. And Searle points this out, he says, it's a very remarkable fact. People ought to pay attention to this, take account of this. Not well recognized in people who talk about philosophy of action, but it is a very striking thing. Now, you ask yourself about your own decisions. It does seem reasonable. It does seem a plausible way to describe what you do when you make a decision. You don't just weigh things up and go. One of the things you can do is decide which decisions are worthy and which decisions aren't worthy. And the ones that aren't worthy, you can discount. If so, you have here an exact description of what the Rambam is saying. The Rambam is saying that you should desire the world to come. Why you should desire it if you're not going to use it for your motivation, I'll tell you in a minute. It's Hashem. You should desire the world to come, but ideally, when you serve God, you shouldn't serve God out of that desire. That desire shouldn't be part of your motivation. Is that a question?
I just want to think, to me, the second reason for your relationship with him, the drinking buddy relationship, would make the first reason look more appealing. Can one interpret that basically you would say that you're trying to discount the second reason, the fact that you're drinking buddies, but at the same time, it already makes you look more favorably at his politics because you have a relationship with him?
Look, it might or might not. You know, if you're an expert in politics and you're an expert in economics, then you have your own independent views on these things, and it's not likely that they're going to change your expert opinion just because you were drinking buddies. And you say, a person can separate out and say, look, these are the policies. I've been studying this for 30 years. I've always supported candidates with these policies. Right, so it's not a new thing.
Uh-huh.
I think you can avoid that. Yeah?
The person knew that he wouldn't get along with what he doing this right now.
Okay, the Rambam says, look, the Rambam says, see, okay. I'll answer with a little bit of elaboration because you're touching on a point which disturbed me once upon a time, but now with this approach I don't need it anymore. You see, if you read chapter 10, start with chapter 10, don't serve God out of a desire for the world to come. One natural thought is, okay, the way to do that is don't desire it. Just kill the desire. If you're not supposed to serve God out of that desire, the easiest way to guarantee that is to kill the desire, right? But the Rambam said in chapter 9, chapter 8, that it is good, right, valid, and appropriate to have desire. So that can't be the way he means you to do it. That's how I got into the pickle. How can you tell me the desire is there, it's right to be there, it's good to be there, it's a motivation, but ultimately you shouldn't serve God out of that motivation? How can you act with the motivation on board, with the motivation relevant, and not act out of that motivation? How can the motivation not give a push? Right? Now what Searle says is, you're not a machine. You're not pushed blindly by your motivations. And not only that, and not just what I said, that you're pushed by your motivations, but you have also free will, which you can add to the picture. You're not pushed by your motivations at all. When you make a decision, your decision is not caused by your motivations. Your decision takes account of your motivations. Your decision may need some motivations for it to decide on. Speaking very abstractly, let me put this in also. According to Searle, you decide to discount the motivation. Does it follow that the guy with the kid in the water is wrong? that I could decide to let the child drown, even though I have no motivation whatsoever to let him drown? That doesn't follow. All circumstances, if I have 17 motivations moving me, I can decide to discount one and act on another. Doesn't follow that I could act if there were none.
It doesn't want to end by itself. So over here, hypothetically, you know, the person has an ultimate motivation, decides to become a mother, and they do it anyway, and they can. But I'm saying that an average person wouldn't do it until it wasn't done until mother.
No, but there is another motivation. The other motivation is do it because it's right. That's what he said. The person
that motivation wasn't found on mother. I mean, he is going to get it. He wants the desire is allowed, but a person wouldn't do it knowing it's right and not getting any reward for it. If it's just that case itself.
But listen, there's a fundamental problem here. Motivation doesn't mean I get something out of it. That's not what motivation means. Motivation means I want it, not that I get something out of it. It is possible to want something for somebody else. My motivation may be that he should be benefited. That's my motivation. What moves me is he should benefit. That's Christian. That's altruism. Right? So to say that I have a motivation doesn't mean I'm getting a profit. It just means I have a desire that it should be done. Whether it's selfish or not depends on what I want. Do I want it for him, or I want it for me? Right? Don't be confused between having a desire versus being selfish. You can't act unless something moves you. This is what I think what Searle is saying. You have various motivations on board. In the decision process, you can decide to act out of this motivation, and you can decide to discount that motivation. It doesn't follow you can act with no motivation at all. It's an ability to discount, not to act without motivation. Right? So our picture will still, the general picture will still be true. You need motivations on both sides. You need a soul and a body. There has to be conflict. There has to be free will. Just that, when you're making a decision, I have some desires in favor of A and some desires against A, I can discount one of the desires and act on the rest of them. So here with the world to come, the picture we get is like this. I have two motivations for doing mitzvahs. One is that I desire the world to come, and the other is God said to do it. If God said to do it, then it's right. And one of my motivations is to do things that are right. Now, I have both motivations on board, and both motivations are urging me, moving me to do the mitzvahs. It is possible to decide to do the mitzvah and discount the motivation of the desire for the world to come. The desire is there, but when I make this decision, I discount that motivation. That's not the reason I'm doing it for. Meaning that even if I didn't have that desire, I would do it. And I would do it in exactly the same way. I have the desire, but the way I'm doing it doesn't depend upon the desire. And if you take away the desire, I would do it in exactly the same way. That seems to me, intuitively anyway, that that's quite possible. I have two desires, because I'm doing it for this, not doing it for that, and I know that if I would change, and that wouldn't be there, I would do it the same way. I can't resist sharing this with you. I don't remember where I read this many years ago. You want to know how happy you are? Imagine that you get a sudden gift of $10 million and ask yourself, how much of your life would you change? The more you would change, the more unhappy you are. Because it means you're only doing what you're doing because you don't have money. If you have money, you'd be doing something else. You don't really prefer doing this. Right? You really prefer doing something else. Just for the sake of the money, you're stuck where you are. Person would say, if someone gave me $10 million, I would basically live the same life that I'm living now as a person who's very happy. Because you have the ability to do any number of other things, and he wouldn't take it. So now, imagine a person who says, I'm working at this job. I have two reasons for working at this job, two motivations. One is I love the job, and the other is I need the money. Indeed, if it didn't pay me, I'd have to do something else, because I gotta have the money. But if somebody gave me $1 million, I would still do this job. I would come on time the same way, I would spend the same hours at it, I would put the same dedication into it. then, as we say, he's not doing it for the money. He needs the money, and he makes the money a condition on working at the job. But that's not why he's doing it. Because if he had the money, he would still do it. So he can say, the money is not what's motivating me to do it, at least in the way that I do it. I don't need that motivation. I need the money, but I don't need that motivation to do what I'm doing. So that being the case, I think the Rambam is, there's too much philosophy and you can get confused about the philosophy of it. And here, Searle has a gift of putting things in a very clear, straight, intuitive way. One of his philosophical messages is, when you learn philosophy, when you study philosophy, don't forget what you know. There are lots of things that you know. Don't let the philosopher tie you around a little finger and you end up denying things that you know. Like, you're really alive, or you're not dreaming, or there's a physical world, or there are facts, and there's truth. You know, he ties you up and says, everything's relevant. They give you a break. Everything's not relevant. And, don't let him convince you of things that you know are wrong. And here, from your everyday experience, you know that when you act, you're not forced by every motivation you have to take that motivation into account when you make your decision. That being the case, and I'm going to say, you have the desire, is appropriate, good, correct, but ultimately you should try to serve God not out of that desire, but because it is the right thing to do. You with me? See, you've worked on a problem for a long time, and God favors you. Yes, so this is very, very satisfying. Now, why should everybody have this desire? Why should everybody have this desire? I think there are two reasons. First of all, as you started to say before, for the vast majority of people, that is a very important motivation to get them to do it. In the beginning, that will be part of the reason why you do it. You will do it for that reason. And as I told you at the beginning also, that's not wrong. Nothing wrong with that. A person serves God in order to get the world to come, the service is valid, and he will be rewarded for that. Nothing wrong with that. You try to eventually mature and outgrow it. But in the meantime, it can be a very strong motivator, and it can bring a person to do mitzvot, as he should, before he graduates to that very exalted position that the Rambam says not even all the sages achieve, to serve God out of love, doing what's right because it's right. The other thing, which is a little more speculative, but I believe it's correct, that desire is built into the person. Desire means I want what I want because I want it. Desire is an ending point in trying to explain something. It's not the only ending point, but it's an ending point. Why are you driving a bus? To earn money. Why do you want money? Buy a house. Why do you want to buy a house? Because I enjoy living in a house. Why do you want to do what you will enjoy? Don't ask stupid questions. Why do I want to do it? Or I'll enjoy it? Because I'll enjoy it. That's why. I mean, I don't need any further reason than that. The enjoyment itself is reason enough. I don't need a further reason to tell you why I'm doing what I enjoy. The fact that I enjoy it is the starting point in explanation. I mean, there might be a further explanation, but there doesn't have to be. That's enough. Desire is built into man's nature. The only variable is, what do we desire? People desire different things, and as you grow and mature and learn, your desire has shifted. Once upon a time, little kids wanted to be firemen. They outgrow that. They want to be president of the United States, and then they outgrow that. The basis of looking for a president, things like that. And what you desire shifts with time. Indeed, you yourself can reprogram your desire to a certain extent. Because you know that certain types of experiences change your desires. If you spend time with very unfortunate people, and you're normal, you will feel such pity, such sympathy for them. You'll experience their tragedy, you won't be the same. For the rest of your life, you'll have a sensitivity to them, and you'll be motivated to help them in a way that wouldn't have been so had you not experienced that. People who want to interest you in ecology will take you for trips to the rainforest. They tell me, once you spend a week in the rainforest, You don't want to see it disappear. You've never been there. It's a matter of abstract politics. But if you've been there and experienced it, it's precious and you don't want it to disappear. And your feelings for it will change and your actions will change. So, being a creature with desires is built in. What can be changed is what you desire. Okay, what's worthy of desire? What's worthy? What really deserves to be desired? Obviously, what deserves to be desired is the greatest good. Desiring other things can just get in your way, because they'll distract you from things that aren't the greatest good. So, given that you are a creature with desires, and desires are a necessary part of your nature, then desiring the world to come is definitely the right way to go, because that is, in fact, the greatest good. There is no greatest good than that. Indeed, in the prior chapter, the Rambam says, the great good that is promised for man is the world to come, period. So I think that this could be the reason why he says that this is the appropriate desire, because desire is necessary. This is the one which is the desire for the highest good. By the way, I want you to know that God is described as having desires. That's not an obvious thing. God is described as having desires. The desire that he's described as having, one that's described several places as having, is a desire to dwell in the lowest realm of existence, to dwell in our world. Po eshev ki visiha. Here I shall dwell because I have desired it. Evil of Oshablo. He desired it as a dwelling place for himself. Chazal say, "Iva dir v'tachtonim." He desired a dwelling place in the lower areas of the creation. So, if God is described as having desires, desires can't be bad. Desires per se can't be wrong. Just what is it that you should desire? Yeah.
But what if your desires are like corrupted? Like if, for example, with me, like me seeing someone dying in front of me would now make a dent on me. My feeling, like, because I come from a culture where, like, death is, like, something that is enjoyed, like, as a sport. Like, watching street fights where people gamble on it, and, I mean, it, like, boils up your blood, like, it's a desire for watching, and, like, you just cheer when someone dies.
Like the Romans. You don't have to think of this as very primitive. The Romans, the great Roman civilization, had the gladiators. And they cheer when people die, they get killed by animals, and so on and so on. It's the same, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, you know where that comes from. The gladiators are in the ring, and they're fighting with one another, and the one has the other out of mercy, he can kill him. And the crowd, the emperor says to the crowd, thumbs up means let him live, thumbs down means kill him. That's how they voted. And the crowd went like this, and the guy killed him. Yeah, and they cheered, like you said. This is a long-standing, not limited in time and space in terms of cultures. Okay, so I think you're right. There has to be a time when a person can work on ridding himself, removing himself. Now, at this point, I must say I'm at the limit of my psychological understanding. But I know that desires can change. They can be strengthened. They can be weakened. I do a little bit. You can weaken desire A by strengthening a contradictory desire B. How do you go about weakening desire directly? I don't know.
Start to leave it.
Yeah, sometimes the actions reinforce the desire. That's right, you can do that. You know how tranquilizers work? Some tranquilizers work that your emotions cause you to tense your muscles. And tense muscles reinforce the emotions, and it's a cycle. And the tranquilizer relaxes the muscles, and it breaks the cycle. And that being the case, that the emotions calm down as well. So there are various ways that you can have access. So I think you're right. You can have utterly corrupt desires, and then, corrupt. Yes, let's say, you chose a good example. Desire people to kill one another. Or fire striking, something like that. Or ice hockey. Did you put that in also? You know, where really the highlight of the game is where the guy takes a stick and hits the other guy and there's blood on the ice, right? Okay, the puck, we know the puck is important from time to time, but it's really important that he gets more ahead. Even if that's what you see them under the net, you know, see those elbows flying, you know, the elbow is high, right? Okay, there are definitely corrupt desires, and the person should work to eradicate those desires. That's right. I mean, that's absolutely correct. In fact, we mentioned the Rambam, in his front talking, says a person has a desire for an action which is intellectually wrong. You can see intellectually that it's wrong. That desire is corrupt and should work to change his personality. Only if it's a desire for something which intellectually is okay, and the Torah says don't do it, like bacon cheeseburgers, then it's okay to have the desire, and one should just work not to act on the desire, not to give in. But so anyway, that's the bottom line. The highest level that one hopes for is serving God out of love, which means serving God for His sake, serving God because He represents the ultimate truth and the ultimate good. And if one does that, then one has achieved the greatest success that a human being can hope to achieve.